My name is Alan Lucas, and I'm a rabbi at Temple Beth Shalom in Roslyn Heights, New York, and I'm very honored to be the moderator of our program this morning. If I might, I'd like to begin as convention is winding down and just say yishar koach to our colleague Felipe Goodman. To his entire committee, to Jan and Ashira and all the RA staff. As the chairman of last year's convention, I know the months of work that go into this, so I hope that all of you will make a point of really personally giving your shukoach to Felipe and thanking him for the wonderful few days we've had here out in Las Vegas. I'd also like to thank for those of you who are watching this via live streaming. I would just like to say to the 10,000 fellow colleagues and rabbis who are gathered in this room, that it's very exciting to be with you here this morning. And
it's the best of them.
Those of you who are way, way in the back, you know, please, if you're going to ask a question, you know, take the 5 minutes that it's going to take to get to the microphone, so we don't have to wait. But thank you. If I might begin with a story to set a quick story to set the theme. 1978, I was a senior rabbinical student at the seminary. I was home for Pesach in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I remember to this day sitting in my rabbi, Fishel Goldfeder's office, Olav Shalom. And his office is fine. He's Olav Shalom. And we were having a conversation. I was a senior rabbinical student, and he was sort of looking back on his 30 or 40 years in the rabbinate and projecting forward to a young rabbi who was about to begin his career. And he was sharing with me things that he had learned and things that he wanted to help me prepare that I would be experiencing in my rabbinate. And when I look back, what was amazing about that conversation was that his assumption, and mine, was that my rabbinate would probably look pretty much like his rabbinate. That the assumptions, the things I would be dealing with, the challenges I would face, would be more or less similar to the challenges that he faced. The skills that I would need were pretty much the skills that he had mastered in his 30 to 40 years as a rabbi. Flash forward to 2011. My son is a fourth-year rabbinical student at the seminary. And when I speak to him, I don't know how to talk to him about what his rabbinate is going to look like 5 years from now. And the assumption, which was so muvan me'alav in my conversation 33 years ago, is just not there today. That what all of us are experiencing every day in the rabbinate is this reality that the ground is literally moving underneath us. Things that we have always known are no longer the basis upon which we could build our future rabbinates. And therefore, all of us are now in the business of trying to figure out what this new rabbinate, new synagogue, new Jewish community is going to look like, and what we as leaders in that community and rabbis need to do to respond to it. So that's what this program is about this morning in small measure. We have with us three wonderful rabbis. I must tell you that each one wanted me to make sure that you know that they are very embarrassed to be sitting before you on the assumption that they've been chosen as successful rabbis. Not that they aren't. But we understand that we probably could have chosen any one of a number of people to sit here. What distinguishes them is that, as you will hear, that I think they have each had an element of success in their rabbinate. But more than that, we've challenged them, and they've been gracious enough to really give thought to something that we all deal with, so that their thoughts, what we hope will be not the end of a conversation, but the beginning of one, that we will also be opening up to you this morning. There is no one answer anymore, if there ever was, how to create a culture of success in our synagogues. Each one of these panelists has created a successful community. They each bring their own strengths and their own personalities to the task at hand. And our hope today is not that you're going to take careful notes and then try and go figure out how you can recreate their programs, as much as we hope they will create today an opportunity to explore and better understand how they each found a way to build on their own strengths and their own passions, their own personalities and their own talents, to transform those personalities and talents into successful communities in the hope that we can all do the same. So just a quick introduction. They, as you can imagine, as successful rabbis, they all have extensive CVs. Rabbi Francine Rosten currently serves as the spiritual leader of Congregation Bethel in South Orange, New Jersey. This is the bat mitzvah year of her rabbinate, having been ordained in 1998. She served in three Jersey congregations, learned a great deal about community building, working with lay leadership, remaining resilient in the face of the many ups and downs of rabbinical life. In 2005, she came to Bethel, and she broke the stained glass ceiling, where she became the first woman in conservative rabbinate to serve a congregation larger than 500 member units. Congregation Bethel has grown continuously over the past 6 years, expanding its membership, professional staff, and local profile. Rabbi Maurizio Balter has been serving the rabbinate since 1983, 12 years in South America, and 16 years in Israel. One of the uniquenesses of his work is the ability to build kehillah. He can guide while building the congregation's visions, recruit, he works with volunteers, builds congregational projects that will fulfill the members of the kehillah with energy and give surrounding members of the community outreach members to join. He has created a unique experience and ambience in his own congregation, especially during services, giving people an opportunity to experience spirituality and Torah study. From 2010 to the present, he is the rabbi of Congregation Eshel Avraham in Be'er Sheva. And prior to that, he was the rabbi of Hakaryot Masorti Congregation in Kiryat Bialik. And our third panelist is Rabbi Seth David Kirshner. He became the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel. David Seth Kirshner in Closter, New Jersey, a congregation of 800 families. Prior to joining Temple Emmanuel, Rabbi Kirshner worked at the Jewish Theological Seminary, which he joined in 1999, serving as senior director of institutional advancement, overseeing the seminary's development and outreach efforts. In addition to reinvigorating all aspects of Temple Emmanuel and strengthening relationships one by one, Rabbi Kirshner is involved in the community at large, holds many positions of leadership. So we've decided that rather than begin by inviting our panelists to each make an opening statement, we're going to proceed directly to the conversation, and that I will address some questions to them, give them each a chance to respond to my questions, to each other, and then we will open the conversation to your questions. So let's begin. What does success look like to you as a rabbi? How would you define a successful rabbi? How would you define a successful community? Francine, you want to begin?
Thank you. So I did not create a successful and vibrant community. I came to an absolutely beautiful community that was nurtured and cared for and loved and taught and led by Rabbi Yechiel Ornstein, who is here. So I am grateful for his leadership and the gifts that he gave to the congregation that I'm now blessed to serve. So in thinking about how I would define a successful community and then my own success, I think a successful community is a dynamic learning community that's continually wrestling with God, with Torah and Tefillah, and striving to lift up all in need of support, embracing all who want to celebrate Jewish life together. I feel like I'll be successful when the synagogue is functioning and pulsating with energy and spirit. It's not about numbers, it's about energy and vitality. When people feel like every time they come to Shabbat services, they learn something new, either a new interpretation of Torah or an interpretation of the tefillah, or that the ceiling won't fall in if the traditional musaf isn't said, or that they can sit in meditative silence and not die, or that they can learn from their fellow congregants. That's all success for me. And the other thing that I think is success is if I have a healthy marriage and happy children, a healthy body, and a content congregation.
David?
First of all, thank you for moderating. It's an honor to be up here with Francine and Mauricio. I agree with everything Francine said. I'm going to say something that might be a little challenged. I actually believe in numbers. I believe we're in the business of selling Judaism. And I hear so many of our colleagues talk about, don't judge it on whether you've had growth or haven't had growth. How else do we judge our success? If our synagogue is growing, and if it's growing organically, it means we're doing our job well. And if it's not, it means there's a chance that we're not doing our job as well as we should. Now, of course, there are other mitigating factors in there. There are economic factors, there are aesthetic factors, there are demographic factors. But I believe a lot of our success should be built on a model of numbers. Not total numbers, but numbers. Meaning, if we look at any other product that's being sold, airline tickets, hotel reservations, food, you judge its success by revenue and by sheer numbers. So why is Judaism different? And I think if we were driven by numbers, it might charge us in a different way to be a little bit more creative, and I believe that that is how I judge a lot of my professional success. My personal success is very hard to quantify. I really like what Francine had to say about a happy wife and a happy children, which is a tremendous challenge for me in managing and balancing all of those important parts. But I think for me, ironically, where I feel the success is on the one-by-one. It's on the not quantifiable, the anecdotal story of the person who had their life changed, who the heart that's been stirred, through the tear you see from the pew, that counts for me as how I feel that I've been a successful person.
Can I just say, numbers are important, but I just don't prioritize them. I mean, I just, you know, and when I'm talking to people and we're evaluating programs.
But does your leadership?
Yeah, they might, but I don't really want them to. I want them to know if we met our goals for the program, for its impact, you know. And the impact that it makes on people's lives, if it inspires them or lifts them up, which is very hard to measure, I understand. And numbers and money is much easier to measure. And I'm doing okay there, but it's not my priority. So just to...
we'll come back. We'll come back.
I understand what you're saying.
We'll come back to this, I promise. Mauricio?
We'll try in English. If you don't understand me, we speak in Hebrew, okay?
In
Hebrew and English.
Hebrew.
Is someone that don't understand Hebrew here?
Can you say in English?
Yeah, Hebrew.
Can you say in English?
I should
know. Muyo.
She spoke faster.
It's okay in Hebrew?
Bakasha?
Yeah, bakasha. Thank you. Please, have a hand.
I'm not sure in France in Banyan's impact. זה דבר חשוב, אבל צריכים להבין שכדי להגדיר קהילה מוצלחת, חשוב להבין את הקונטקסט. זה לא אותו דבר קהילה מוצלחת בארצות הברית מקהילה מוצלחת בישראל. ושבשבילי, כן, זה חשוב מאוד האימפקט לא רק בחברים בקהילה, אלא האימפקט בעיר איפה שאני גר. זאת אומרת, קהילה מוצלחת מביאה מודל לאנשים בתוך הקהילה וגם לאנשים שלא באים לקהילה, שמסתכלים על הקהילה ורואים בה מקום של השראה, של אינספירנס. וזה חשוב להגיד, וזה חשוב ללמוד מזה, כן? אני חושב שקהילה מוצלחת זה קהילה שמקיימת את השם. קהילה זה מלהקל, מלהביא כולם ביחד. כן? להביא כולם ביחד. ואז זה ביחד יש לו גם התכונות. ערבות הדדית, דאגה אחד לשני, מקום איפה שכולנו ביחד מרגישים איזה ביטחון. עכשיו, שוב, הקונטקסט מאוד קובע. אז ביטחון בשבילנו בישראל זה שבכנסת זה מקלט רוחני. spiritual shelter. שיש רגעים בחיים שלנו שאנחנו צריכים את החוזק של הקהילה כדי להחזיק מעמד מול האיומים שאנחנו חשים, שאנחנו חווים, טילים, מלחמות וכו'. קהילה מוצלחת זה קהילה שנותן מהות לחיים של אנשים שבאים בחיים בה. מהות, כן? זה דבר מאוד חשוב. אם אנחנו רק נותנים שירותים, only service, זה לא מספיק. אם אנחנו רוצים להיות קהילות חשובות, צריכים לתת מהות לחיים של אנשים. כמו שאני אומר, מי זה רב מוצלח? מי שמצליח לנגוע בחיים של אנשים שמסביב. אם אנחנו מצליחים לנגוע בהם, לשנות משהו מהתפיסה שלהם כלפי החיים, כלפי אלוהים, כלפי היהדות, זה רב מוצלח לדמי. אנחנו צריכים לנגוע. כל עוד אנחנו מצליחים לעשות את זה, לאט לאט, זה משנה את הקהילה ומשנה את הסביבה, לא רק את הקהילה, את האוטריץ' באוטריץ' שלנו, בעבודה, אנחנו משנים את החברה. וזה תיקון עולם, במובן הכי, הכי פשוט של המילה. דיוויד, אתה רוצה להגיד משהו?
מה אתה עושה את זה? I didn't understand anything you said.
No,
kidding.
You want to say Spanish? It's
Spanish. I want to peel the onion just one layer on this issue of impact and try and tie it into number, because I couldn't agree with both of you more. Impact is obviously what we're all after, any of our worlds. And I want to give it to an example of actually something that Adam Austin and I did together on this trip, because I was having breakfast with a colleague this morning who was sharing, lamenting some frustration on one of our outings to see one of the unique suites that we saw at one of the hotels just off the strip. The question was, why would we go there? What's the purpose of it? I don't see what that value that has to our rabbi. And I responded to him that on Tuesday of this coming week, please God, our synagogue is starting a major construction plan. And one of the cornerstones of that addition in our building is called a moedon, but internally, for the strategic group, it's called the Starbucks room, meaning the entire room is being built on the model of Starbucks. Periodicals, Wi-Fi's, fruit, coffee, open 24/7, comfortable chairs, chairs you can do a $1 million business meeting, chairs you can look in your laptop on your own, chairs you can have a conversation with your friend. The purpose of that is to make another portal in the congregation that people can come, enter, and be comfortable. Because if they get in the door, the chances of me making impact are much higher. And I share that example with you, and the example of that suite that we saw was to say, how do they get customers off the street and bring them in there? How do they get the $10,000 person in? Because if the only portal we have is the door to the sanctuary, you're eliminating 80% of our congregation on a regular basis. And our synagogues need to be trafficked on a greater level. So I think one of the areas where we need to, sticking with the catchphrase of the week, get out of the box, is figure out what those portals for impact are. What are the ways that we create impact? And for me, where I've been challenged and where I enjoy the struggle of my rabbinate is realizing where the impact can be for the congregant as opposed to where the impact is for me. I don't know if I'm articulating that clearly. Yeah. But that, I think, I'm in agreement with you. I just wanted to fine-tune where I am on that.
And if I could push this just one step forward, I think there is a tension that exists between our definition of success and some of our lay leadership's definition of success.
Absolutely.
And I think the more we are mindful that it's not, there is no one definition. Our synagogue's operated on many levels. Any rabbi who generally tells me it's not about the numbers, I already know that they're in a synagogue, that they've been successful with their numbers. Speak to a colleague whose synagogue is struggling with numbers, and they will tell you that's all they're hearing from their leadership is, what are you going to do to get the numbers up, get the numbers up? Once you have those numbers, then, but most of us were drawn to the rabbin for the impact kind of issues. Balancing those are really the challenge, and working with multiple levels of success and multiple models, I think, is really, really the challenge. It's not either or, yes or no,
right,
but all of them together. Maurizio, you created a community in Israel that was a model of civic engagement. It's an expression of the highest level of social service. You are completely enmeshed in the lives of your people. Why did you choose this particular direction to express your rabbinate? Was it an expression of your personality, or was it an external? Was it a communal need that led you to this direction? In other words, what was the initial impetus, internal or external?
This merge of both of them. זה בא ממקום שאתה, זה מעניין איפה נולד פרויקט. היא נולד מהצרכים של אנשים או מהחזון שלך. זה באמצע של שני הדברים האלו נולד פרויקט קהילתי מוצלח. בין החזון והערכים שלך לצרכים של אנשים. אם זה רק החזון שלך, זה לא יהיה. אם זה רק הצרכים של אנשים, אתה בחוץ מהפרויקט הזה. אז זה התחיל באמת כשהתחלנו פרויקט עלייה, כשהייתי בצפון, בקריית ביאליק, התחילו להגיע עולים, הגיעו 500 משפחות שאני עזרתי להם לעלות לקריית ביאליק, ובצורה טבעית הפכתי להיות הרב כמו רב של שטייטל, כן? כל שאלה הם היו באים לשאול, במה להתעסק, אם לפתוח עסק, לא כמו רב מלובביץ', לא לתת ברכה, אלא לתת עצה. וזה התחיל מהמקום הזה של הצרכים של האנשים, יחד עם החזון שלי לעזור למשפחות להגיע לארץ. ואחר כך אני ראיתי שיש הרבה אנשים שהם לא עולים, שגם יש להם את הצרכים האלו. ושוב הגיעה מלחמת לבנון השנייה, ואז ראש העיר שמכיר את הצורה שלי ביקש שאני אבקר מקלטים ציבוריים, לא של אנשים מהקהילה. ואז הפכתי להיות מעורב בחיים של אנשים של העיר, שלא מהקהילה. וככה זה הופך להיות, זה כנראה חלק מהאישיות. איך שאני רואה את התפקיד של הרב, שזה תומך רוחני לכל אחד שפונה עליו, וגם כן מהצרכים של אנשים. שתבינו שבישראל אין רבנים שעושים מה שאנחנו רגילים לעשות עם חברים שלנו בקהילות. בכלל בישראל אני הייתי אומר שהרבנים יותר במובן הפולחן, השגיח כשרות, לא תומך רוחני, לא עזרה ולא לפתוח יד ולעזור. אני חושב שזה הבדל, זה חלק מהאישיות, אבל זה חלק מהחזון גם כן. איך אני רואה את התפקיד שלי כרב ואיך אני רואה את הקהילה. לתת כלים לאנשים להתפתח לבד, אבל ללוות אותם. לתת להם את האפשרות שיהיה להם רפרנט איפה שהם יכולים לפנות, לשאול ולסמוך.
And they seem to be responding, the response to this very different model of a rabbi than they're used to seeing in Israel, they seem to be just responding in droves to the kind of model that you're presenting for them.
נכון, נכון מאוד. זה שונה לגמרי, אבל זה מה שמאפיין לא אותי, יש הרבה רבנים בתנועה שעושים את זה בארץ. אבל זה, בגלל זה אמרתי שזה דבר מאוד חשוב, כשאנחנו מדברים על הצלחה, על סקסס, צריכים להבין את הקונטקסט, ושאם אנחנו לא יודעים לקרוא את הקונטקסט נכון, פעם למדתי באיזשהו חוג, שלמדו אותי שאתה מגיע למקום חדש, תיקח 3 חודשים, ותקנה את כל העיתונים המקומיים, תפגוש את כל האנשים המקומיים, אל תגיד מילה. ושאתה לא יודע איפה שאתה נמצא, אפילו שזה באותה מדינה, באותו מקום, אתה צריך להבין את הקונטקסט לעומק. כן? וזה חשוב מאוד. כשגעתי לבר שבע, במשך 3 חודשים עשיתי חוגי בית, עם אנשים שבאים לקהילה, עם אנשים שהיו בקהילה ועם אנשים שאף פעם לא היו בקהילה. במשך 3 חודשים רק ישבתי איתם ושמעתי מה הם צריכים, מה הם מצפים מהרב, מה הם רוצים מהקהילה. ואחרי זה התחלתי לבנות פרויקט. ושם קונטקסט מאוד קובע. ומה שאנחנו יכולים להגדיר כהצלחה גדולה מאוד במקום מסוים, במקום השני, יכול להיות כישלון טוטאלי.
David, your success takes a very different form from Mauricio's. You seem to have built a successful community that is an extension of your charismatic personality. You sought to build a community through the dynamic relationship of your members with you personally in a very individual way, inviting them into your home, hosting hundreds for Shabbat dinner, if you might want to talk about that program. How did you come to this particular formula, and why does it work for you?
First, I just want to say, I go to Israel often. I was there during the Second Lebanon War, and the mayor of Ma'ale Adumim was talking about the heroes of the war, and he was referring to Maurizio. Not only the soldiers on the front line, but the work that Maurizio was doing. And I think when you talk about real leadership for our movement and the Jewish people, what you're doing in Israel is amazing, Maurizio. So to address your question, Alan, you know, there are two forms of our relationship with God. There's a transcendent God and there's an immanent God. And in many ways, our rabbinates are similar, obviously, Bahá'u'lláh. We have transcendent moments with our congregation and we have immanent moments with our congregation. But the way that we move our congregants is going to be much more impactful and going to move the needle significantly more on the imminent moments. I think I'm a decent preacher, and I can make someone cry a sermon, and I can talk to them where it's affecting their lives. But there's nothing like breaking bread with the congregant. There's nothing like having them at Shabbat table and letting them see who you are. And you learning who they are to build a personal relationship. When I came to my congregation, I came from the development world. So I broke a lot of bread with a lot of people. And I learned the art of small talk, which led to greater talk. And as you can tell by looking at me, I broke an awful lot of bread. And I built into my contract an entertainment allowance that encourages us to do this in a way so that it doesn't feel like a financial burden. And it doesn't feel like a personal burden, because built into there, we have someone come to our home every Shabbat. She sets the table for us. She puts the food out. She cleans up afterwards so that my wife and I can entertain, and it doesn't feel like a challenge for either of us. And in doing so, we've had to date, finishing my fourth year at the congregation, including open house barbecues that we do for different demographic groups, close to 650 people from the congregation for different meals in those 4 years. So we do that because that builds the intimate relationship. And my wife and I, 2 to 3 times a year, we go out to breakfast or lunch, we bring a shul roster, and we start checking off the names. We keep a list of everyone who came. So sometimes we have a new members barbecue at our house that will bring 35, 40 people. Sometimes we just have a Shabbat dinner, we'll have anywhere from 2 to 4 couples at a time. And then all the couples that I marry, I have for Shabbat dinner as part of the process of training them. And I do that because I just think the imminence you get in that relationship is key. And the other thing I do is I have very few meetings in my office. I live in a bedroom community in Manhattan. I have 3 to 4 breakfasts a day. And I start my meetings anywhere from 6 to 6:30 in the morning. I do a lot of study groups at that hour. And then I go to a one diner, which New Jersey is famous for, to the next diner, to the next diner, and sit with somebody and try and catch up with those people, depending on who it is, once a year, once every half year, once every quarter, just to keep a pulse on their lives. And for me, doing that over a cup of coffee, a grapefruit, an omelet, makes all the difference. It just makes all the difference.
Francine, you represent yet another avenue for success. Some have described your style as being very collaborative, that you've used experimental, innovative worship services to attract people. You seek to empower people to create programs for themselves within the community. Why did you choose this particular path, and how is it an expression of who you are?
So very similar to Mauricio's answer, it's part who I am and my ideals, my beliefs about what I want my rabbinate to be, and part necessity, part who the kilah is. Congregation Bethel is known to be a very ground-up, grassroots, lay-led culture. And
was it that way before you got there?
It was that way before I got there. It was one of the things that made it beautiful to me, that people, there was a culture of strategic planning. There was a culture of being thoughtful about what they were doing. There was a culture of very, very strong lay leadership. Now that brings with it its own challenges, but it was That was very beautiful to me, because what I believe about the reason I wanted to be a rabbi since I was a little girl was that I loved Judaism, I loved Jewish life, and I wanted to show other people how they could engage in Judaism and love it the way I do, to lower the boundaries for people, to show them their capacity, their capabilities, and then watch them go, you know, watch them go off. You know, I think the community is best when I'm not needed, and I don't want the community dependent on my presence. And so, you know, it worked. I think that's one of the reasons why Bethel and I work together. Certainly, I lead with a vision, but I always connect the vision that I'm developing to the values of the community, and pointing out, this is what I see in Bethel, this is what is beautiful about you, and this is how I think we can get to the next level of that. You know, this is how we can achieve being the best of who we are, who you were before I got here, who you are when I'm not here. And, you know, so I'm happy when I'm watching someone who, since I've been there, is a regular shul goer, a regular Shabbat service attendee, someone stand up and give a Dvar Torah that comes from the heart and shows a study and growth of Torah learning. So it's not me standing up there, but, you know, that we've made an impact, that we've touched someone's life, and they're going out and spreading that. So it's part of who I am, and it's part of who Bethel is. And that's also the way I nurture my professional team, that we're a team. I don't like saying staff meeting. I'm really, like, crazy about words. It's a team meeting, and we meet every week, which sometimes is a lot, but every other week we're studying. And I learned this from Sharon Brous and from Rolly Madelon. We started studying, we read some books together, but then we started studying Netivot Shalom on Tefillah and talking about our own prayer lives. I mean, the Chazan and I sit and talk and plan services, which is new. Neither of us was trained to do that. But we started talking about how we feel when we pray with the preschool director and the education director and the executive director. And that, I think, just brought us all to a new sense of who we are and who we were together, and I talk about that in the congregation and let them know that we're learning and we're constantly growing and changing just like we hope they are. So I'm always mentioning what we're doing to model for them.
Marcia?
I think that we have a tension between four couples of values: vision and mission, passion and belief.
Wait, what's the first word?
Passion.
Passion.
Passion and belief. People and needs. Context and possibilities. כל אחד מהזוגות האלה זה מתח שרב קהילתי צריך להתמודד איתם. ואנחנו צריכים ללכת באמצע ביניהם, כן? ושזה לא ברור באיזה צד אנחנו צריכים להיות, כן? זה חשוב גם לציין שאנחנו כל הזמן במסוע מתן בין שני הדברים האלה, כל הזמן, כל יום. זה לא משהו שאנחנו יכולים, כן, לקבוע מראש, אלא שכל יום אנחנו צריכים להתמודד ולהיכנס למסוע מתן במתח שיש בין כל אחד מהזוגות האלו, כדי לדעת איפה אנחנו צריכים לשים את הדגש. דבר נוסף, יש בעיה לפעמים כדי להגדיר קהילה, לא פעם, לא פעמיים, בדיונים בין עמיתים, מה זה קהילה? בהצלחה מדברים על מספרים, אתה מדבר על מספרים, אתה מדבר על אימפקט. איך אנחנו מגדירים למי אנחנו, מי שייך לקהילה? כן? זה שאלה מאוד מאוד חשובה. מי הקהילה שלנו? כדי לדעת מה האימפקט, וכדי לדעת מי, כמה אנשים. ואני טוען שאנחנו צריכים להיות מאוד, מאוד לארג'ים, פתוחים. כמו שאנחנו מדברים על 70 פנים לתורה, אני באופן אישי מדבר על 70 שערים לקהילה. כל שער נותן לכל יהודי את האפשר להיכנס לקהילה בשער שמתאים לו. יש אחד שירצה ללמוד, יש אחד שירצה להתפלל, יש אחד שיעבור רק לפרויקטים של צדק חברתי, יש אחד שיעבור רק לפרויקטים של חיילים, אחד לילדים שלו, 70 שערים לקהילה, אבל צריכים להיות מספיק גמישים כדי להבין שלא כל אחד נכנס באותו שער לקהילה. אבל זה חשוב לדעת לאן השערים האלה מובילים. זה לא רק להיכנס לקהילה, אלא שיש מקום של מפגש של כולם. לא חשוב למה הם באו, העיקר בשבילנו הם אנחנו מצליחים להפגיש את כולם במקום אחד. ודבר אחרון שאני רוצה להגיד בקונטקסט הזה שאת אמרת, זה הקשר עם המתנדבים, עם ה-lay people, שזה דבר חשוב מאוד. lay people ומתנדבים זה לב קהילה. אם אנחנו חושבים שהרבנים זה לב הקהילה, אנחנו טועים. זה האגו שלנו שאומר שאנחנו מרכז הקהילה. זה לא נכון. אנחנו משרתים את הקהילה, לא קהילה משרתת אותנו. ואז אם אנחנו משרתים את הקהילה, הלי פיפל והמתנדבים, זה הקשר שלנו עם השטח. אין מביאים מה שמתרחש יום יום. הם עושים לנו במתח עם כל הערכים לדעת איפה לשים את הדגש. בבר שבע, בקהילה שלנו, יש היום 100 מתנדבים בכל מיני פרויקטים, כן? ואנחנו מקווים שאני שנה בקהילה, ועוד שנתיים יהיו 200. אני מבטיח לכם, ושזה הגישה שלי לעבודה קהילתית. בלי מתנדבים ובלי ועד חזק, אנחנו לא בונים קהילה, בונים מונומנט לעצמנו.
And just to push this though, one step forward, and I'm sure it's each of your own sense of modesty that prevented you to go in this direction of the question that I asked, but I want to press you on it. Absolutely, Mauricio, we agree that it's a matter of finding that balance between your own passion and the needs of the community, and that's our job to navigate that. But still, I would like to, there is so much of you in the particular way that you went about creating the places that you're in. And what I'd like you to just tease out a little bit more is, do you believe this is something where you had an understanding of this before and then went about your work in a deliberate way? Or is it something more which, looking back, you now see that the particular road or that you've traveled is in fact, has your signature all over and your style all over it?
I'm going to say something without the intention of offending, so I apologize in advance. I went to an RTR once, and we did this Myers-Briggs where we divided the room, and 75% of the room I was in was an introverted room,
right.
And all of them were pulpit rabbis. And I happen to be a very extroverted person. My wife makes me look introverted. She's so extroverted. I don't know how pulpit rabbis can be introverted and be successful. I think part of my personal success has to do with my personal DNA, how I'm wired. I'm an outgoing guy. I make conversation with people. I like breaking bread. I like company. I like those environments. That makes my rabbinate easier. And I think that that's mission critical in a business world that we live in. And when I say business, I mean the interpersonal business that we are in. So I think that that's been critical. I also firmly believe, you know, there are two models. Model one is we're gonna stand on the bima, we're gonna model what should be done, and people are gonna follow. Or model two is we're gonna get down in the pews and we're gonna get people to get on the bima. I believe in the latter, right? I don't believe in preaching on topics that I think people should listen to. I believe in preaching on topics where the shoe pinches for everyone else. And by telling them the shoe's pinching there, that there is a way that Judaism and conservative Judaism speaks to this issue. So I don't give topics or conversations on Heschel or Wissenschaft or the seminary or any of those things that we talk amongst ourselves with and we might find exciting and dynamic. I talk about issues of suicide and mental illness, which is running rampant amongst our youth. I talk about Facebook. I aging parents, which is the exact demographic of my congregation, which are all 30 to 50-somethings, and are all burying their parents and dealing with serious illnesses. And I talked to them about what Judaism has to say about it. Because I find if I talk about what I want to talk about through that Jewish lens, it'll capture 10% of my congregation. And I find that if I talk about what they're struggling with, which I find over those meals, and I find over those interpersonal times, that I'm capturing, casting a much wider net and capturing many more. And I'm going to say one other thing as constructive criticism for our movement. I get all types of periodicals from our movement. You get them too. You get the Conservative Judaism book, you get Conservative Judaism magazine, you get all types of these things. In my congregation, which I would argue is a centrist, run-of-the-mill congregation, I could send that to my entire congregation, 10% of them would pick it up, 5% would read it, 3% would enjoy it. That's a true statistic. And I would take that statistic and think. And if we're sitting here in this convention lamenting about our struggles, we need to make communication of all sorts, both in the technological world and the printed world, in a way that speaks to our congregants and in a way that they can pick up any one of those magazines. It isn't loaded with words, you don't want to look at it. This is not what our people are reading. Our people, who are sophisticated, smart people, are reading the Wall Street Journal, they're reading the New York Times, they're watching the Today Show, and they're reading People magazine. And if we don't create a format like that, how do we expect to reach them in such a heavy way? And it just caters to that top echelons of academic snobbery, excuse me, and it makes everyone else feel inferior, and I work very hard on bridging that gap so that people can feel that our movement and Judaism as a whole has something to say with the issues that they're dealing with.
Either of you want to react to, not necessarily to that, but to...
Well, I love being with people. I love hearing people's stories and realizing and helping them to realize that I am not so much different from them. And they are not so much different from me. And so I try to talk about what I'm struggling with. And it's not a Rashi, but it's, you know, issues of faith and meaning and theology and you know, try to share my heart. And the more I share my heart, the more I connect. I have noticed at different points, you know, speaking to colleagues and friends, you know, I've noticed at different points, depending on how I've been treated in the rabbinate, what the downs of my career have been in contrast to the ups, that I sometimes close off my heart and protect myself, and it's safer to stay in the Rashi. And I try to really push hard to be a real person and to connect with people on that level.
שאתם אומרים, אני חושב שחלק מהסוד זה השקעה באנשים. השקעה. הזמן שלנו מוקדש לאנשים. דבר שני זה הקשבה. רב טוב צריך לדעת להקשיב יותר ממה שהוא מדבר. אם הוא מדבר כל הזמן, הוא לא תופס מה שקורה בבני אדם שהוא מטפל. דבר שלישי, אני לא עובד כרב. אני רב, זה לא full-time job, זה full-life job. ויש הבדל, כשמישהו בא ושואל, אני רוצה לעבוד כרב, אני אומר, לך לדבר אחר. אם אתה רוצה להיות רב, תיכנס לנושא.
יפה.
יש הבדל משמעותי מאוד בין מי שרב, בכל החיים שלו, כמו ששומעים כל אחד שיושב כאן, ואני בטוח מרוב עמיתים שלנו, רב קהילה, זה כל החיים שלך. אתה מוסר את עצמך לאחרים, אבל לא לטעות. אנחנו לא עובדים כדי שיעבו אותם. זה לא, יש כאלו גם כן. הרב שלנו, הרב מרשל מאיר, זכרו לברכה, היה מלמד אותם. אם כל הקהילה אוהב אותך, אתה רב גרוע. אתה לא אומר לאנשים מה שאתה צריך לפעמים להגיד לאנשים. אם אף אחד מהקהילה לא אוהב אותך, אתה רב גרוע. ואנחנו צריכים לחיות שוב במתח הזה גם כן, שלפעמים צריכים להגיד משהו שהשני לא כל כך אוהב לשמוע, אבל אנחנו חייבים להגיד לו שזה התפקיד שלנו, ושם אנחנו צריכים להיות. אז זה השקעה באנשים, הקשבה, לדעת שלא כולם יעבו אותנו, ולמסירה טוטלית שלנו לגבי האנשים בקהילה.
This speaks to your question now, and it speaks to what Francine just said also, which deeply resonated with me, and I'm trying to say it to a quick story. When I worked in the developmental world for the seminary, and then I worked in the congregational world, which was, for all intents and purposes, a career change. And as I was going to the congregational world, I was at a board of rabbis meeting in my community before I had started, and as we witnessed the beginning of the sunset, my parents gave me two first names, which was very confusing, and someone got confused again, and they said, well, it doesn't matter because your congregants were calling you rabbi. And I thought to myself, they're going to call me rabbi. They'll probably call me David or David Seth. And they said, don't ever do that. This rabbi was clearly a veteran, didn't see him, points his finger, whacks it in my face, don't ever let them do that. And he went on to explain to me why I shouldn't do that, and I came home, and I remember saying to my wife, holy shit, so scary, I thought they'd call me David or David, they gotta call me rabbi. And she goes, I'm not calling you rabbi. I don't think they should, they'll call you whatever they want to call you. I give that as an example, Alan, because I think your point really resonated with me, and I struggle with that, as Maurizio was saying, and not to what they call us. I'm trying to get to the bigger point here. I think there's a significant paralysis out there of a fear. And the fear is paralyzing a lot of rabbis. A good friend of mine who graduated with me, who wants to get involved in APAC, says to me, I'm very involved in APAC, and says to me, I'm worried because there's a significant contingent of my shul who's involved in J Street. I said, well, do you believe in APAC? He says, yeah. I said, do you believe in J Street? He said, no. I said, so support APAC? Well, I'm worried about offending those people. And I see he's stuck in this paralysis of fear. And fear is paralyzing. And my friend Felipe, who is like a brother to me, I love him dearly, has been an incredible role model for me. And his success is based on being fearless. His success is based on courage. And for me, I have found that my greatest successes have been when I've conquered my fears. But when I am beholden to my fears, I find that I end up in a holding pattern and I'm paralyzed. And I find it so scary and dangerous place to be.
I knew a colleague whose wife used to refer to him as a rabbi, and we all used to wonder what their intimate moments sounded like, right? But let's...
I had another thought on the question that you had.
Please.
creating a culture of success. And I had one of the things that I say is that I'm always trying to create a culture of experimentation and being willing to try things and being willing to have them fail and helping people live in the discomfort of the change and not immediately go backward. And so, you know, this question of how does it connect with who you are, I mean, I'm a woman rabbi. I've broken boundaries. I've taken risks. You know, I can't be scared, and I can't be put into a box. It's the same. It's like, and I try to not be the bull in the china shop. Like it's like, you know, I don't want to hurt anyone, but I admire.
You don't want to be Felipe, right?
No, I want to be Felipe. But, I stand in front of the Ark many times at the start of the Torah service and ask for courage. So
let's see if let me also now move a little into each of you specifically and try and nail some details down as opposed to just some of the generalities we've been speaking about. So Francine, you followed a longtime beloved rabbi, as you mentioned. What special challenges did this present you? You had to balance the synagogue of the past and yet bring it forward into the future. You also conducted recently a successful fundraising campaign in the midst of a financial turndown. Could you comment on some of these challenges?
So Rabbi Orenstein's here. And it was a challenge not because of Rabbi Ornstein, but because, you know, the congregation had to adjust to a new leader. Interestingly, what people told me after the first Yomim Noraim was that I definitely wasn't Yechiel. I was a girl. So, like, that wasn't too hard. I spent a lot of time listening, and the first year I tried not to change much, which was really hard for me because I'm pretty impatient. And so I really tried to listen for the core values of the community and then, you know, lead with those. So you mentioned my fundraising. So we're towards the end of a renovation and a capital campaign that's been going on through a recession. And I really think that one of the reasons it's been successful is we've always led with our vision. That when any time I went and talked to people about what we were doing, it was our primary reason for renovation was accessibility. And making sure that anyone who walked in that building could get up to the Torah, could get down to the lower level, and could get up to a class on the upper level. And it resonated with people because it spoke to who we were. We also didn't build just for ourselves. We also partnered with the Houses of Worship in South Orange Maplewood. And we built a house with Habitat for Humanity. It's called Abraham House. It's a project that you can do in your communities. And it really touched people who were resistant to building an edifice. And so they felt like no matter what we built, as minimal as it was, they were offended. But when we said we're not just building for ourselves, we're also building for others, and we wouldn't build for ourselves without building for others, that touched people. And then the other way that we're able to, I feel like, you know, some of it was luck, but we got a very nice, beautiful gift from someone who grew up in the congregation, who doesn't even go to my synagogue, but who experienced the warmth and support of the congregation when his mother died, who was a member of the congregation, and that, you know, that vitality that is not a vitality of outer marketing, but that vitality of the life of the synagogue that he experienced in the support of the congregation, that showed him the strong future of the congregation, and he invested.
David, you've taken 5 congregational trips to Israel in the last 4 years. How did you accomplish this? Why do you believe it's an important part of your agenda? And also, I think a little extension of something you began to speak about before is our movement. We talk a lot about experiencing a membership decline, and yet your synagogue is experiencing dramatic growth. Can you explain this?
I'll start with Israel. When I did my career change from the seminary to the congregational rabbi, I picked 6 rabbis that I thought were successful in the field. And I kind of charted them out in a very strategic way, tried to pull out the key ingredients to their successes. And the overarching successes were trips to Israel. It was one of the common denominators of all of them. So I realized that was going to be an important part of my rabbi. From my first trip that we took, we had 80 people go in my first year. And the relationships that I built on that trip, 2 weeks in Israel, bar mitzvahing and bat mitzvahing the children at the southern side of the Kotel, just everything that you do there, not only was it valuable for me, for the social capital, it was valuable for the synagogue, because every single one of those congregants came back different people. They came back different people in their homes, in the community, and at our shul. They're all leaders now. Half of them are on the board. It's from 4 years ago. But they weren't on the board. They never came to services. A lot of them just want to go on this vacation because where they were at the time. So we've made that a principle, and we've created trips for different demographics. We did an empty nesters trip. We did a seniors trip. We're doing youth trips. Family Bnei Mitzvah that we do every 2 years. So I firmly believe that universally, from our movement, universally, every single one of our United Synagogue congregations should have an absolute symbiotic relationship with Israel. We should be working on going to Israel at least once every 3-4 years in our communities and congregations. And congregations that don't have the wherewithal, the means to make that happen, should partner with other ones in the community to make that happen. And that should be something we stand in unison and chant loudly from the rooftops and all be a part of. Because us not having a relationship with Israel or a synagogue that hasn't been there in the last 5 years is tantamount to having a peanut butter sandwich without jelly on it. It just doesn't work. Our synagogues need to have relationships with Israel. And to what Maurizio says, it is a key portal. Not a portal, it's probably 10 of the 70 portals you spoke of. And I think that's critical. You know, as far as the growth, I'm not saying this to be humble. I don't know what it's about. The only thing I can tell you very proudly is that our growth has all been organic. There have been no gimmicks. So I came to the congregation, we were tickling 600 families, and now 4 years later, we're at 785 families. So what we've done is just try to figure out this phrase that my friend Aaron teases me about all the time, is where's the shoe pinching for people, and trying to create those portals exactly as Maurizio spoke about, as what I spoke about for my first year at the synagogue, trying to create these modes of entry for people. And I think creating those different modes, as opposed to just the sanctuary door, has led to our organic growth.
And where are some of the places where the shoe is pinching people with respect to synagogue affiliation?
I think, you know, what we have now, I'll give you a great example of, I think, one of our growth areas that has to do with this fear issue. It kind of answers all the questions in one. A lot of it has to do with what are we doing with the post-bar mitzvah group. We do anywhere from 50 to 70 b'nai mitzvah a year in our congregation. And we had a tremendous drop-off afterwards, 90%. And Chabad was capturing all of them in our community. And they were doing this thing called the Friendship Circle. You probably had the same, I see all of you nodding, all 6,000 people here. And they capture these people, and we don't seem to get them back. And they're feeding them, and they're engaging them, and they were capturing all our kids, I mean 40, 50 kids. So I went to one of our people over breakfast, and I sent in $35,000 for the next 2 years to pilot a program called Temple Emmanuel's Face-to-Face, which was the exact model, without one difference, to what Chabad was doing. Social action, community service credit, in the synagogue, we were going to feed them, we were going to hire the right staff. I got $35,000, we did it for 2 years. Every Wednesday night, we have 27 to 35 kids come, they get community service, they study, we give them pizza, pasta, burger, something. And it works. So that wasn't a case of innovation, that was opportunity. So I think some of this has to do with modeling best practices, even if they're somewhere else, and not being, you know, inhibited by that, and creating these portals for our kids. We also have done a lot in adult education. We have a thing called, we call it 2Jew, which is Temple Emmanuel Wednesday Jewish University. So we have 4 to 5 different classes happen every Wednesday night at the synagogue. So no matter what, you know your address at the temple on Wednesday. And whether you want to come for a kosher cooking class, you want to come for Melton, you want to come for the Torah Institute sponsored by JTS, you want to come to do a Cantor's sing-song class, we have it all. So we know that Wednesday night is your night on the calendar that you programmed it for. So those are the kinds of things that we've done.
Can I sure. Jump on, piggyback on that? You know, we're talking about fear and we're talking about barriers. And I think all of us are trying to lower the barriers. Some of what we do is messaging and just trying to remove the boundaries from the outside and within make it more welcoming once they come in. So we openly, loudly advertise that we're open to gay and lesbian families, to intermarried families. And even though we're often told, wait, but you're a conservative synagogue, are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure, I'm the rabbi. We're out there saying, yeah, actually, whoever, I say it all the time, whoever wants to lead a Jewish life and raise Jewish children and create a Jewish home, then I want you to come journey with us if we're the right fit. And we not only do that messaging outside, but I do a lot of that messaging inside and teach people how to live in that diversity and care for each other and not say, you know, cruel things that they don't realize. So, you know, constantly nurturing from the inside and messaging from the outside to say you're not going to be judged when you come into our community. You're not going to be laughed at when you make a mistake or chastised when you make a mistake. You know, it's very sad to me sometimes that the Bema feels a little like the seminary sometimes, you know, where, you know, you're terrified to make the wrong move. And you know, that is not, I don't want that fear anywhere in my, anywhere in a shul that I am davening in.
And Mauricio, you, I think you addressed a little bit, but if you would address again, how did you come to understand the unique context of your community, and how were you able to connect yourself, your creativity and your passion with the reality that you found yourself in, and why is activism such an important part of what you do?
אני אתחיל מהסיפה.
אוקיי.
אקטיביזם זה חשוב, זה מודל. אני רוצה שאנשים יתנדבו ויהיו פעילים בקהילה שלי, אני הראשון שצריך להיות מתנדב. אז זה דבר פשוט. דבר שני, אכפת לי ממה שקורה בתנועה שלי, בגלל זה אני עסקן יושב ראש של התנועה. בכנסת הרבנים, בגלל זה אני נשיא כנסת הרבנים בישראל. ובכל מיני תחומים, אני מאוד פעיל, שאכפת לי, פשוט זה חלק מהאמונה שלי. עכשיו, בקשר לקונטקסט, זה מעניין. אני הגעתי לפני 10 חודשים לבאר שבע, בקהילה שכמו שפרנסין אמרה, יש הרבה זכות לקודמים שלי, הרב גיל הדרור, הרב גיל נטיף, היו רבנים של הקהילה. אחד מהדברים שאמרו לאנשים אחרי 3 חודשים זה פתאום הבנו שיש לאן להמשיך. חשבנו שהגענו לטופ ויש לאן להמשיך. תשמע, אנחנו קהילה שיש לה 8 גני ילדים, 230 ילדים. ואנחנו השנה, בספטמבר, פותחים בית ספר יסודי. זו פעם ראשונה שקהילה במדינת ישראל פותח בית ספר יסודי מסורתי, קשור עם קהילה, יחד עם העירייה, שזה דבר גדול מאוד בשבילנו. אנחנו עובדים עכשיו, למשל, עם פרויקט אחר, שזה פרויקט של איכות הסביבה. לקחנו פארק ציבורי, אימצנו אותו, באנו לעירייה, ביצענו להיות שותפים. עכשיו אנחנו עובדים על פרויקט אקולוגי, על הפארק הזה. יבואו יחידות של הצבא לעבוד במקום, סטודנטים לבתי ספר לעבוד במקום. אנחנו מזמינים את כל השכנים לעבוד בפרויקט של מקורות ואקולוגיה. אני לומד, כל יום אני לומד את הקונטקסט. הקמנו פרויקט של ארגונים פלורליסטיים יהודים בנגב ביוזמתי. אנחנו עושים תיקון ליל שבועות לכל העיר פתוח. 15 ארגונים יהודים שלא מסכימים בכל דבר, אבל כולם פלורליסטים, ביחד במרכז העיר, תיקון עולם לכל אנשים, דתיים וחילונים. וזה לומד כל יום, וכל יום מנסה להבין יותר, ויש גם עוד מתח שאני רוצה להוסיף לזוגות שאמרתי, שזה בין יצירה ותגובה. אם קהילה רק מגיבה למה שמתרחש, או קהילה יכולה ליצור קונטקסט חדש. וזה מתח גם כן שכל אחד מאיתנו מתמודד איתו, ואני חושב שאנחנו עם מספיק אמיצים, דיברנו על להיות אמיצים, צריכים גם כן ליצור חלק מהקונטקסט, אנחנו צריכים לשנות אותו וליצור.
יופי. So we have a few minutes left, so we'll open if anyone wants to find their way to the microphone for a couple questions. The microphone is right there, right by you.
This is a...
Because they're recording.
A question regarding success in the daily menu. Has any of you faced that challenge? Or what are you doing to make it successful? And to get the numbers in and to get people to daven on a regular basis daily.
It's a great question. I struggle with it daily. We have an evening menu, we don't have a morning menu. 2 things we did. Because of our Hebrew school hours, we changed the hours so that they correspond and overlap with the menu. So our menu is at 7 o'clock every night, dismissal is at 7:15. So our kids in 6th and 7th grade are required to go to menu, and most of the parents who come for pickup then come. We do the same thing on the Wednesday night program I was describing. So that those Wednesday night programs, the IT kids and the face-to-face kids and the programs that we have, they come in, and we never have problems on Tuesday or Wednesday because of the natural traffic that's in the building.
Thank you.
But we face the challenge on Monday and Thursday.
So we have a morning minion, and they've done a few things. First, they had this Jewry duty that you might all have, where you send postcards and tell people it's their time to come, and they don't come. So what we started was we have a minion captain for each day. All the minion captains are given the yard site list for the week, and they can call the people who have yard sites, or they call the people they know, and each captain for that day is supposed to help guarantee a minyan. And again, like other things, I don't make the minyan dependent on my presence, and I encourage those types of activities so that they are taking care of securing the minyan, not me. Although since I have all the congregants in my phone, often I'm calling, you know, not often, thank God, but then, you know, I'm often there calling to get
אנחנו עובדים, אין לנו מניין יומי עדיין.
עדיין.
אנחנו נגיע למניין יומי. יש לנו, כל החגים, יש לנו ראש חודש, הוספנו ראש חודש עכשיו כניסיון להביא באמצע שבוע, שאני גם כן לתפילה. ויש לנו גם כן בוודאי ועדת ניחום אבלים של כל שיבה שיש למישהו, הקהילה באה להתפלל אצלם. אנחנו בדרך עובדים על זה, יהיה עוד מעט בעצם השני. Yeah.
Danny?
Robert Daniel, President of Saratoga, California. I've been interested in for a long time the whole side of the Synod on governance. And just to mention two aspects of this, I think that the way most of us are set up with boards that are in the nonprofit world would be considered too large, the whole structure seems to make it harder to be nimble, to be things strategically, and so some of us overcome that, and of course in any congregations they sink to the lowest possible level of faults of that kind of structure. So how much attention have you paid to structural stuff, the governance, the board function? Have you changed the way things are organized in terms of that? Obviously, all of you have a good partnership relationship with your lay leaders, which is of course necessary, but I know sometimes, I work hard on this, and sometimes it's just a hard degree of difficulty, you know, I have more hard work than trying to get.
So we've had some interesting things happen in the past couple of years. It's been difficult to fulfill sort of this leadership transition, which is part of coming into a new place. And they had a hard time filling board seats and vice presidencies. So for the past couple of years, we've done a few different things. We brought Bob Leventhal in, Bob Waif. If you haven't met him, you should talk to him. We brought him in for a leadership training for our board. And then I have led discussions, but then I've encouraged my leadership to be thoughtful. And we reorganized and actually have more vice presidents than we've ever had. Because we looked at our functions and the burden, no one wanted to be in the leadership because it was too big a burden. And we were really intentional about the makeup, the goals, the priorities of the congregation. The board had a number of discussions and created these new vice presidents. And so I think we have like seven vice presidents. We have this year, and they didn't have trouble getting people to say yes to those because each one had a specific mission and a specific vision, and it wasn't overwhelming. But again, it was a lot of discussion and visioning, and I think it only started bearing fruit when I wasn't at the core of it. So it wasn't the rabbi telling them what to do. It was them realizing for themselves.
אנחנו לפני שנה, כשאני הגעתי לקהילה, הבת היה של שבעה נשים. אני מאוד עודדתי שיהיו יותר אנשים. אנחנו בת של 15 אנשים היום, וכמוך יש לנו עבודה כל הזמן של הקהילה ופיתוח מתנדבים. מבחוץ שבאים ועובדים ארגונים, יש ארגון שבא לעובד עם הבת כל הזמן כדי לעזור להם להיות יותר חזקים וללמוד יותר לתפקיד שלהם כדי שיהיו יותר יעילים בעבודה קהילתית.
כן, כן.
So, our time is up. So, and as a former convention chairman, I wouldn't want to do this to Felipe. So, I will just end by giving each one of our panelists, if you want any opportunity to say a final word.
And just I see someone with the last question.
Ask your question, then we'll ignore it. But go ahead.
What do you want from your congregation? Where are you?
What do you want?
So, we can't really close.
What do you want, and where are you leading your congregation?
You know, this whole, I think the question of how we lead and how much we're leading from the front and how much we're leading from the middle and how much we're leading from the back is like the million-dollar question. And I'm all the time trying to figure out, am I a rabbi that builds coalitions and collaboration because as a woman, people don't accept when I get up there and tell them what to do. And they don't like a woman of authority. I'm not sure. Maybe you could tell me when you stand up and tell them what to do, they don't like that either. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much is me and how much is in reaction to the atmosphere and how much is in reaction to what people can take. I'm really not sure. What do I want for my congregation? I want them to be living good lives that are, you know, inspiring, and I want them to take care of each other and every once in a while take care of me.
אני מנסה שאנשים יאהבו את היהדות. זה הלידי שלי, שכל אחד יאהב את היהדות. המציאות בארץ שונה, זה שאם אני מצליח שבן אדם יתקרב ויאהב את היהדות, אחר כך מה שהוא יעשה עם היהדות שלו זה החלטה אישית, וזה הנושא. אני מאוד אוהב לשיתוף עם אנשים. אפילו אני אגיד עוד משהו שלא אמרתי קודם, נזכרתי שזה דבר חשוב מאוד, אפילו הגדרה שלי של מרא דאתרא, זה הגדרה שאני מחליט את החלטות הלכתיות יחד עם הקהילה. זאת אומרת, אני רואה את התפקיד הזה בשיתוף עם הקהילה, גם את החלטות הלכתיות יחד עם הקהילה, לא לבד.
First of all, I thank you for moderating, and I want to thank Francine and Maurizio. For me, the honor is just really being up here with all of you, so thank you. In my house, there's a picture of David Ben-Gurion on a beach standing on his head. You saw the picture, right? To me, that's the most inspirational picture. Ben-Gurion knew more Tanakh than anyone on the faculty at the seminary, and that's not to degrade anyone at the faculty. And he changed an entire country and an entire religion. But by him being on his head, it always reminds me of the words, why not, right? Similar to what Kennedy said. So for me, in answering your question and in closing words, I, being part of this committee with Felipe and this convention, I'm challenged by why not. People in my congregation, leadership, they always say, why do you do it this way? We've always done it this way. This is the way it's happened. Why not? So when Christmas coincided with Shabbat this year, we had Chinese food for Kiddush.
Why not?
And we had 200 people. And
yep.
People said, why are we doing this?
Why not?
Right? And I think of that picture of Ben-Gurion on his head, and I think if we did that with our rabbis a little more, and we asked the question, why not, a little more, then perhaps we're going to be, you know, on that same level with our congregations, and then we'll see more of that organic growth.
Yeah. Thank you to each of you, and to everyone, a safe journey home.
Thank you.